Der Design-Podcast der Burg.
Very, very welcome to the Hurra Hurra Podcast, and this is our 21st edition, and as you can hear, this is not in German language, as some rare episodes are in English language, and I'm very happy to welcome, to introduce, to have as a guest, Zach Lieberman, and as it is a tradition in this podcast, just after I just say a few minutes, I would like to ask you to introduce yourself, because it's so difficult to get all these various identities from yourself into one kind of sense-making sentence. Just to be clear for the podcast, this is a podcast about design educations and the challenges we gonna face during the pandemic, during the changing expectations on what design is and for whom we design and in what kind of tool chains we are situated in. And Zachary Lieberman is, in a way, one of the great spokespersons when it comes to working with code and in art and design contexts. And just starting off with that, very welcome, Zach. Just tell us a bit who you are. What are you doing?
Thank you. Super excited to be here. Ich kann ein bisschen Deutsch sprechen.
Ah, na sehr gut. Dann machen wir das in Deutsch.
Probably not a whole podcast. So I'm an artist based in New York. I divide my time in thirds, so one third teaching, one third doing commercial work, one third doing artistic practice, sort of one third, one third, one third. In terms of teaching, I helped start and teach at a school called the School for Poetic Computation. And before that, I was a professor at Parsons, which is a design school in New York. And for the last 2 years, I've been started a professorship at MIT in the Media Lab, where I'm starting a group called Future Sketches. In terms of my artwork, I do a lot of exploration with code and interaction, building strange tools, drawing tools, a lot of daily sketching, posting on Instagram, making prints, doing exhibitions. And then in terms of commercial work, a lot of it is kind of generative design practice, working with design studios. So for example, I just did a project with Lane and Associates and Pentagram Design, which was a redesign of the Freeze, the identity for the Freeze Art Fair. And I did some kind of animations that and graphics for different kind of membership options. So it's stuff like that, which is kind of working with the client and taking the things that I love and translating it into a brief.
Is it always like 33% of each, or does it change from time to time?
You know, I'm not like super religious about it. I know some people who are really big into time tracking and try to be really conscious. I think I had just have a kind of internal thermostat, and I can tell like, okay, I'm just doing too much commercial work. I'm doing too much artwork. I'm doing too much teaching. And the whole point is to try to keep those things really balanced.
And like, because I'm a professor too, and it's a full professorship. So, still, I try to have my my business running just as a creative practice to don't lose track in a way, but also having that kind of non-commercial, like social-based practice as a teacher for like people who do not have access to creative technology knowledge. But do you have only just a third? I don't know the expression, but like a third professorship, or can you just manage that in a way?
Oh, I have a weird position at the Media Lab. I'm an adjunct associate, which is a kind of, like in the English, the way we talk about professors is sort of a strange term, but I'm a half-time professor.
Okay, so that's what they call the adjunct thing.
Yeah. I'm an adjunct, but it's not the same. Like in America, if you say adjunct, it has a different in meaning. Because a lot of universities sort of rely on adjuncts to teach the majority of the classes. So those are the kind of professors that might teach one class a semester and not really be involved in at the professor level, like in kind of those sorts of design of curriculum. I'm more of a professor than an adjunct at the Media Lab. Like I have a group, I'm accepting students, you know, I have projects, but I'm not there because I'm based in New York. I go back and forth between Cambridge and in New York.
And as we were talking about your work at the MIT Media Lab, it's called Future Sketches. And as I'm following your work, you do these daily sketches. And how does that relate? And what is your, like, as would say, like, the pedagogical approach on that? Der pädagogische Anspruch.
Nice. I love it. Well, so the term Future Sketches comes from a letter that Muriel Cooper wrote, you know, where Muriel Cooper was one of the founders of the Media Lab. She had a group there called the Visual Language Workshop. And she was writing a letter in the 80s to a journal to describe the work of the group. And instead of writing an article, she, you know, created this visual essay. And in the cover letter, she said, you know, she's describing what they're trying to do with this visual essay. And then at the end, she says, this stands as a sketch for the future. And I love this phrase so much. I love this idea of sketching for the future. So that's where the term comes from. It's really an homage to Muriel Cooper and her work and the legacy of her students. And in terms of the approach, the pedagogical approach, there were two groups at the Media Lab. There's the Visual Language Workshop and then John Maida's Aesthetics and Computation group. And both of those groups really, I think, are very important. The Visual Language Workshop, extremely important because of the really pioneering work with early explorations of typography and computation, experimenting with kind of what will graphic design field look like, breaking down the barrier between production and creation. And the Aesthetics and Computation group are just, it's so such an important part. If you're in the world of creative coding, if you think about things like processing, that comes from the Aesthetics and Computation group. And for me, I have such a passion for that work. When I was a student, I was excited about computers, and I would go to the computer section in the bookstore, and every book was terrible. They were all telling you how, you know, how to code, how to do this, how to do that. And then I picked up this book by John Maida called Design by Numbers. And this book was why. This book was telling you why. And you know when you find a book that really opens a door for you? Like it's, you know, just like a literal door that you can climb through and there's a whole new world. And for me, that was the kind of book where the moment I opened this book and there was just a paragraphs about iteration or paragraphs about randomness and describing the poetry of code, describing the essence of code, you know, those words were really revelatory for me. So it was the work of John Maida and then, his students at the lab. There were so many great students that came through that group. And so part of my, you know, I guess you would say mission at the Media Lab is to create a group that can continue the, you know, follow in the footsteps of those groups, looking at the intersection of art, design, and computation, thinking about what tools do we need, right? We've had a great set of tools that have brought us from kind of like the, you know, early era of creative coding where you needed a computer science degree, you needed to be working on an SGI machine, you needed really fancy, expensive equipment to, you know, this era of kind of relentless exploration, lower barriers, higher ceilings, et cetera. But, you know, part of it, the challenge is to figure out what are the next set of tools. And my hope is that the students in my group will be making projects, but then also be making tools. And collectively, we'll try to learn what are the tools that we need in for this next generation.
I'm very interested in that because the idea of having a research group is something really interesting. So is it really interlinked with your teaching activities, or is it something different? Mm-hmm. Do you teach your group, or do you teach others and you have your group? How does that work?
So at the Media Lab, you have the groups are very small because it's a sort of a strange model. Your students are paid, which is very rare. It's less rare at the PhD level, but it's very rare at the master's level that you would have master. Media Lab is a master's and PhD level program. and your students are paid. And so in a way, your groups are very small, very focused versus something like, you know, yeah, it's just different. You teach the students that you work with in your group, and they teach you, and you work on projects together, mm-hmm. but then you also have courses. So I teach courses, and I'll have students from the Media Lab, I'll have students from the architecture department, I have a lot of students from Harvard, GSD, from Mass Art, you know, you have students from the kind of the area, and but you are, yeah, you're teaching more than just, because I will have, for example, maybe two or three students next mm-hmm. year, not...
Wow, that's quite a good key of how people how many people you have, but from the way you teach, and because that's what I find really interesting is that you describe yourself like in the literally second word as an educator, and and you've been co-founding the School for Poetic Computation. Does that in a way, I don't know, but I ask you, is that the way where you come from and kind of a tradition that you kind of build your own and that you're going to transfer to your teaching at the Media Lab? Or is it something totally different?
Yeah. I mean, the School for Poetic Computation started in 2013, and it really started because a group of friends and I got tired of university life, that we were... You know, we were on the outside, we were adjuncts, and then we got slowly worked our way into the inside and just felt like, okay, nothing's happening with these programs, you know, whether it's Parsons or SVA or these sort of programs in New York. And at that time, there was a real push for alternative models for education. So in New York, there's a really famous design school called Cooper Union mm-hmm. that has been for many years free because of the financial model. The person who founded it was really wealthy, you know, left a ton of money. And then that the endowment has paid for students to go without paying tuition. And that's amazing. And then in 2013, the board had kind of squandered the money. They built a big building. They did a lot of things wrong. And then they suddenly have to start charging tuition. And the mm-hmm. students were going crazy. The students took over the president's office. They were protesting. It was really like kind of amazing to see the energy. And we just started to feel like we don't know what's going on with universities. You would see NYU, Parsons, these universities building big campuses in Abu Dhabi and, you know, in Shanghai and all these kind of remote, you know, satellite universities and big buildings. And at the same time, I just felt like the students were paying so much money. The tuition was going up and up and up, and I just couldn't see where the money was going. And so the whole idea was to say, okay, can we do something much simpler? So a lot of times I would meet these students who would be coming to Parsons for a 2 years master's program, and I kind of felt like they were curious, and maybe what they needed was something more like a semester. So rather than having 2 years where you go through and you take a bunch of courses and you do your last year, you're writing a thesis, maybe they need something smaller. And so we designed this program where we have a 10-week program. We have students come from all over the world, based in New York, based in America, and worldwide. We have about 15 to 18 students at SFPC for this kind of 10-week program. Mm-hmm. And we chose 10 weeks because you don't need a visa to come to... A lot of people don't need a visa to come to America. I mean, not everybody, but it's, there's a sort of general idea, like you can come to the U.S. for 12 weeks. So the idea is like maybe you take a week to find an apartment, and then you have this 10-week program. And we try to keep the cost really low. You know, it's hard in New York. And it's hard to come and live in New York. It's not a cheap city to live in. But we try to keep the cost low. We try to be really open and transparent with the budget and all of these things that we just didn't see in the university that we were a part of.
Yeah. It's totally interesting. But what courses have that been? Rachel here, like Rachel Uva, who's
Oh yeah, Rachel was one of the first. I mean, she was in the first cohort.
Oh, cool.
Where we really didn't know what we were doing. She was a student. And it was, yeah, it's been really great to see her school. What we do is organize our pedagogy around three temples. So we have code, electronics, and theory. And we think of these things as the kind of centerpieces for poetic computation. In terms of code, I teach classes in visual coding. So we're doing a lot of, I can talk very specifically about my class, but I have a class called Recreating the Past, where we recreate artworks and designs from the past using modern tools in order to have a conversation. So it's almost a class in exploring media art from the viewpoint of different artists and designers. Mm-hmm. And it gives us a chance to talk about them and study them. There are classes in working with language, so computational approaches to language. There are classes in physical computing, both sort of low level, where you're learning really about circuitry and what are the circuits that make up, that make computation possible, and then also microcontrollers, so Arduinos and so on. And then there are classes in theory where you're really reading and writing about art and developing kind of critical language and perspective around artistic practice. So those three things are the kind of tentpole for the curriculum. And then we have special courses. So there are like different courses that are offered from time to time, whether it's around craft and computation or, you know, there's just various things or special programs that happen.
And in at the MIT Media Lab, it's very focused on one thing then. So it's not that kind of holistic approach as it in the SFPC was.
Yeah, I mean, at the Media Lab, I let my students will do independent projects. What I want them is to figure out an area of expertise where they'll say, like, I want to become an expert in the relationship of dance and computation, mm-hmm. or the relationship of typography and computation, or the relationship of, you know, I don't know, craft and, you know, textile design and computation. And then from that, I want them to take that interest, develop a set of projects, but then also tools around those projects and ultimately a thesis around those projects.
And how does it work with COVID then, right now?
Yeah, I mean, COVID has been really challenging. Obviously, we went offline. We went online. We moved, you know, everything went virtual in March. And it was really dramatic. It was really, really dramatic how quickly it happened. You know, it's not a lot of planning. And it has been interesting. In the spring, I would say that I...
Very diplomatic. Interesting.
Yeah, it's been interesting. In the spring, I was really disappointed because, you know, I had this whole plan for a kind of fun... I had a really fun class in the spring at MIT around drawing and computation. We had the 10-week program. We had students who had committed. They were coming to New York. They were buying plane tickets. You know, we had to cancel. We had really precarious financial situation with SFPC because we don't have any... We have these long periods where we don't have students. And then you have this 10-week program. We had to refund all the money for the students who were coming, and we just had no programming. And it was really hard to think about, even like, you know, we're paying rent on a space. We have a physical space we can't go to. We're learning how to work remotely. And so in the summer, we worked really hard to get courses online at SFPC. And rather than doing a 10-week program, we had individual teachers offer their courses at different times and in different ways. We kind of relentless experimentation. I taught three sections over the summer where I would teach from, you know, 9:30 to 11:30 and 1 to 3 and 5 to 7 because I had students from different time zones, mm-hmm. you know, and they wanted to take the class. And we offered... People had always asked us for online courses. We were like, oh, that's not going to work. You know, we never offered it. And we had, when I offered my course, I had 190 applicants, you know, who want to take the course. So, okay, well, then what do? We'll offer more sections. We do three sections with about 15 or about 18 students each. And And it was crazy. It was really fun. It was really stressful, really challenging, really different. I think there are obvious drawbacks to teaching remotely. But I had a student, for example, over the summer, and she wrote this beautiful letter at the end of the course where she said, you know, she had a chronic disease, and she physically couldn't travel. So there's no way that she would be able to come to, come to the school. And at the beginning, she was coming to the course from her bed. Like, she would be in bed when she was, remoting into the class. And I was like, okay, like, I didn't know. I had no idea what was going on with her. And at the end, she said, you know, this meant so much to me to be able to have this weekly moment to get together with people, to be able to share ideas. And, you know, and I think about her, I think about students who were around the world, like really, really globally, and we were all going through the same thing at the same time. And to me, that's so beautiful. It's so different. And I think there are, you know, there's this like crazy downside, but then there's also a real potential upsides to online education where you can create, you know, situations where people are, the normal barriers are breaking down in terms of how people communicate and how classes can happen.
That is very interesting. Because as I said in the before the recording, that I was a bit scrolling through that Gone Virtual Slack channel that ended in like mid of last year, like in mid 2020, yep. And mm-hmm. if you scroll it through a bit, it starts in March. So like in the height of the pandemic when everything went loose, and it's such an immense craze on, hey, let's talk about it, let's do it, because that's what I also see in this online education, that we use these tools that we somehow used because we had to use them because they were like they are essential, but now we use them for the like, okay, let's connect, and it went really well to see, okay, there's this Google Doc running with all the links here, use that, use this, that's like the things that we do.
I mean, I was surprised. So one, I really like collective writing, and I've mm-hmm. done it in class before. Like when we're in person, I teach this class called Recreating the Past, and what I do for course, the class is about 2 hours long, or maybe about usually three, but when I do it online, it's two, and I have asynchronous content. But I will come in, you know, we'll review homework. I will give a lecture, maybe half an hour, about an artist. I'll talk about Muriel Cooper, Vera Molnar, John Whitney, John Maida, just interesting artists and designers. I'll talk about their work, explain what their work means to me. And then we open up a collective document and we just start writing. And I ask the students, just research, find as much interesting information as you can, find quotes, find bibliography. And year after year, I've taught this course for multiple years, the students are finding new things. They're really like, they love this idea of just kind of scouring across the internet, across, you know, journals and books or whatever they can get their hands on to find information about these people. And that's the sort of thing that, like, that's an activity we do in person, but it translates really well online. You know, it's really fine. It's really interesting to be mm-hmm. kind of in a document together.
What did not translate so fine?
Yeah, I mean, one of the challenges about coding in particular, and I think this is almost a kind of ergonomic thing about coding, is that it's just so helpful to be able to sit next to somebody and see what they do, because you will see them type. It's like a physical act, right? You're typing and you're seeing something. It's probably the same thing. I watch my daughter take drumming lessons remotely. She has virtual drumming.
And with a real drum set or with an electronic drum set?
She has an electronic drum set, and then she has like a camera pointed at her, and then somebody's like Skype, you know, on a Skype call with mm-hmm. her, and he's got a drum set, and he'll play something, and he'll you know, he sends some music notation to us and we'll print it out and she'll play. Mm-hmm. And it's like he's watching her and he'll be like, oh, try this. But it's probably different if you're in the room and you can really see like, okay, this is probably what's happening. And then the same thing with code. With students, I can instantly tell when they have a compiler error. I'm so used to it, you know, that I can be like, oh, let's try this. You know, you're missing a semicolon, parentheses, you know, and it's that kind of very like quick thing. Like, oh, I can just look over the shoulder and say something. Or I can say like, let me grab your laptop and show you how I would do it. And there's a kind of like, because you're coding, it's such a solitary experience. It's you with a text editor trying to make something work. And when you can be together with somebody, there's something really powerful about that. Like just sharing a laptop back and forth or showing typing for somebody. And, you know, and part of my brain is like wired to deal with like grabbing somebody else's laptop and like the keyboard is different. I'm just so used to it. I'm really used to just kind of like communicating through code with other people. And part of the challenge with being remote is that that's not possible. So then we're doing things like screen sharing, mm-hmm. and students are showing me their screen or they're sending me code and I'll quickly edit it and send it back to them. And I'm trying to find new ways of just like, what is the over the shoulder view? Because the over the shoulder view is like, I think it's just really important to see that they see how somebody who has a lot more experience, like looks at what they've done and can kind of teach them those skills to fix. Like when I was learning design, I had a job and I had a boss and I would make something. And then he would all the time, it was so beautiful. He'd just take a piece of tracing paper and he'd say like, okay, let's look at what you did. And it's like, you see somebody that's done it for a long time, take a piece of tracing paper on top of what you've done and say like, look at this composition, or like, what if we did this? What if we did that? And that very simple act of taking something that somebody's done and showing them something else about it that is harder to do remotely. And that's something that I really, I totally miss. But we've been trying to, figure out how to make it work online.
Yeah, that's very interesting that you address a physical aspect on the action of coding that mm-hmm. is by working with like computational artists and programmers and coders together. I rarely seen that, but it was more like a weird aspect of their normal behavior. Like usually they go in the Gollum state and just like type, and then. And then they exchange, of course, but I thought exchanging on a creativity on presence, because you've been working with dance also, like that having mm-hmm. beyond articulating aspects of aesthetics design that are beyond code might have been much more greater problem than the also very like true aspect that you've been talking about.
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of ways, I as a teacher, I sort of put that on my students. But so, like, I try to show them, these interesting artists and designers, and have them kind of sit in their world and with their eyes for a bit, and have them make work. But I have my students talk to each other mm-hmm. and my students present work and kind of ask each other questions. And I kind of want them to develop those sorts of insights. And then sometimes when we have like office hours, students will show me something and I'll remix it or show them what's possible. But I am almost, when they're in that sort of course, I want them to be I want them to just to be learning by making. And I almost am not like pushing them. I want them to push themselves. There are other situations. I'm advising thesis. Mm-hmm. You know, I read thesis projects for students and I'll push students and I'll push them, especially on the conceptual, like how rigorous is their idea or their presentation or the the thing that they want to make. But in these kind of classes, I think it's clear to the students if they've done a good job or not. Because their homework is to recreate something. And so they can see it's almost side by side. Is it close? Is it not close? They can have that kind of conversation. They can learn by looking. And I don't spend a lot of time pushing them on their kind of individual aesthetics.
Because as you said that we have limited time. I want to talk about something that came across my Twitter timeline in the last days. Yeah. And maybe for the listeners, co-developed Open Frameworks, one of the most impressive coding environments for visual computation. And you did this together with Arturo Castro.
Yeah.
And Arturo was tweeting like a thread on how artists in the US promote themselves. I might quote for a second. So it's like a long tweet. It's from the 4th February of 2021. So, and he said in one of these tweets, so if you want your day to day not to be miserable, you need to earn a relative ton of money. That's why a lot of independent artists there sound like brands and have the need to constantly advertise themselves. They do not have much options. So it's more about the economic situation and economic anxiety that that artists in the US have next to the COVID plus to all that other neoliberal stuff that's going on there. And that that really touched me, that whole thread, because it's so it's very different from the artistic market or like creative development market that we have here in Germany or in Europe. And I want to ask you, as a teacher, educator, trainer of these young creative minds and people, how do you prepare them for a let's call it a market reality, or is it something that is more an individual development or of themselves, of the people?
That's a good question. I think in general it's helpful for students to know how work is made. And one of my favorite lectures is I walk them through the process of pitching work. I show them like a project from the first email. I show them the pitch deck. I show them all of the back and forth, because when I went to school, nobody showed me any of that stuff. And and you learn when you see a pitch deck that somebody put time into. And you see, and you can, you know, I just go through my inbox and I read emails and I show them like, here's where we negotiated, here's where we have problems. And it's a really like I think it's really helpful for students to see the mechanics of work and that work, that this is work. They'll look at a project, right? And you suffer from this too. Like you go to a conference and you'll see people present work and talk about themselves, talk about their projects, but you don't realize like all of the things that go into it, all of the emails and the charts and the diagrams and the discussions and
the back and forth.
And the discussions. Yeah, the discussion. What do I do for a living? I write email. and so I think that's important. I think it's also important for students to understand the mechanics of the job market. And then also like there are pros and cons to different types of jobs. There are pros and cons to different types of situations. You know, some students want stability. Some students want to be independent. Some students want to like have their own studio. They have different dreams. And part of it is to kind of give realistic and informative examples, or a lot of times when I have students, especially at SFPC, you get a lot of students who come to New York, they want to stay, right? They do 10 weeks, they get hooked, they're excited, they want to come back, they want to work. And so they find studios, et cetera. And I'll connect students and have them talk to people. And one of the challenges that I find, I think there are two big challenges. One is that there are certain categories of jobs that feel like they're creative, but are really
not
like Yeah, really not. Or really like soul sucking. Like, you know, working for an advertising agency, it's like, okay, there's cool clients, maybe a cool brief, a cool brand, whatever. But at the end of the day, you have these these people who have like real artistic vision, and they have something that they need to nurture, and it becomes their side project, and the side projects become smaller and smaller or harder to manage. And, mm-hmm. you know, I think it's really sad, and I'm always really anxious. I'm anxious about advertising agencies because I think that they are, they can be really, you know, sort of crush the sort of artist, that thing which is really important, right? The desire to make something, the desire to put something out in the world, it can get really crushed in some certain types of environments. And then also the big technology companies, where it's really easy for example, my students to go really directly to something like Google Creative Lab, which is an amazing, like, Google has these great groups. Like, I've worked with them and I'm friends with a lot of people there, like Google Creative Lab, Google Arts and Culture, Facebook. I have friends and former students who go work at Facebook. They go work, you know, at Twitter and these big, you know, these big companies, big tech companies. And I think it's really like there are pros and cons. And one of the challenges is if you're in this field, these companies have like a really like oversized impact, right? If you're doing things, if you make projects for Google, they have a really big impact. A lot of people look at mm-hmm. them and it's like suddenly you are telling Google's story, right? You're the work that you're doing is really like that's creating the conversation that they want to tell. Not that that's a trap, but I just want students to be really aware of that and aware of like, they need to know if they go in that direction, that that's what they want to do.
How do you make them aware of that? Like what story or what narrative do you come up with to not wave the index finger like, so think twice, guys.
I try to be really honest about my own practice because mm-hmm. I have experience like working for these companies. I've experienced working on my own. I try to tell, you know, I think it's really helpful for students to sort of hear about your own practice and your own ethical dilemmas. In general, one thing that I think is a conversation that I really like to start with my students is to talk about how when you work in the field of art and technology, you wind up there is a force that sort of pushes you in a certain direction to making. So for example, if some sort of technology is the new hype, like machine learning, or, you know, everybody's talking about AR, or everybody's talking about VR, whatever it is, 10 years ago, it was 5 years ago, it was big data, you know, data visualization, like everybody there's some hype, there's something that people are really excited about. When you do projects in that arena, the press will want to write about it because it's obviously a really popular moment. So you wind up getting this sort of perverse feedback loop of getting like rewarded for working on these types of projects. But the challenge is that it can sort of push you in the direction of being a demo maker, mm-hmm. right? If you really are sort of technology first and you say like, okay, I'm really excited about machine learning and then I'm going to make this thing that shows this thing about machine learning, then like your ideas are in service of the technology. Then you are really like technology first, art second. And I'd like to talk to my students about this, is how do you develop art first ideas? What does it mean to develop an art first idea? And we really try to unpack that and think about that. And I talk about those, that feedback loop and how in my own life that's really scary to me, where I get really excited. I'm obviously really excited about augmented reality. I make projects and then it's almost scary when I'll make something that's like an AR project. It'll get, you know, a lot more likes, a lot more attention, press attention. And you start to feel like, okay, am I just making AR demos, right? Am I becoming am I telling the story that Apple wants to tell? Am I telling a story that Google wants to tell? Or am I telling a story that Zach Lieberman wants to tell? And that's like that conversation I try to unpack for my students. I try to talk about those ethical dilemmas. And then, yeah, that think they can learn by talking about it.
Mm-hmm. What comes to my mind listening to you is that you use the word art. I don't know if you make a difference to design, because like in Germany or in the German language, we have like, we say design, and design is something that is Gestaltung, like creating something, and also Entwerfen, which comes more from the planning idea, like artistically developing something. But in the English world, it's design that is completely everything. So is art?
Yeah.
Do you make a difference in when you say?
I do. I mean, when I think of design, I think about either, like, when I'm doing things that are about communicating information, or when I'm, like, in terms of kind of interface design or UI, UX design or something like that. And then in general, like, the design practice to me is something where you typically have a client, you have a brief, I think about it like, you know where you need to get to. Like, maybe there's some unknowns, but it's almost like you're in a new city and you have a map and you're walking around in the daytime. And art to me is like this thing where it's at nighttime, you don't have a map, you're walking around, you get a little lost, you turn the corner, you don't like the way things look, you come back, you know. And part of it is this kind of like, it's that, you know, that magic of walking around a city that you don't know at night and getting lost and feeling like you know when it's uncomfortable and you say, okay, let me go back to some place that I know. And I remember that park was over there. You know, and I think artistic practice is about the exploration of the known and the unknown, the sort of comfort and uncomfort. And it's really, I like to think, I mean, maybe there is more of a map than I think, but I like to think about it as a sort of unstructured exploration of an unknown space. And design is like more of a structured exploration of an unknown space, where it's almost like walking around in the daytime. It's much easier to map.
Yeah, and like from listening to you, I would say that what you describe art is one methodology within the design process to get along, and getting lost early, getting lost often, and then
I'm sure. No, and I'm sure there's like I have a lot of trouble with these terms. I mean, part of it is like, yeah. Part of it is also like I have recently gotten a lot more success in the design field. So I've had, you know, I've been doing media art for a long time, and then recently started doing, you know, talks at AIGA and going to design programs and working with students. And then obviously at Media Lab have this sort of connection to this design tradition there. And so sort of like, you know, my practice has shifted towards the design community, but I still, you know, I'm trained in the arts. My background is in fine arts.
Yeah, but because your work is so much related to design questions, working within a technology is something that is like, from my, I have an industrial design background. That's what we got like press trained on. So like technology first thing, and you have to serve. And that's something.
And I would say also the thing is like, when I hang out, so I hung out recently with this Swiss type designers. They're called ABC Dynamo. They're like a really nice kind of type foundry. We were out in California, you know, for some project. And I was remember that we did a presentation together, and they were talking about the tiniest changes to letter forms. They were talking about this tiniest minute things, and I thought like, that's my people. Like, that's okay. I was never trained in type design, but like, that's my people. The people that really like look, that really care and talk about these tiny details, and these tiny details have a really big impact. And I feel the same way when I'm coding. You know, when you change a number, when you change just a tiny thing in the program, it has a big impact. And I feel a lot of sympathy with what they do.
Yeah, in the description of your future sketches group, you call that computational craft. Is it related to that really taking care on the details, on the hidden aspects?
Yeah, I think it's my alarm is clocked.
Yeah, 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 because sorry, I see also it's like 10 seconds till you get to leave.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, I got maybe 3 minutes.
Okay.
Sorry, ask the question one more time. What
computational craft, hidden details? What yeah. is it important, or is that relating to the typography craft idea?
I mean, I think craft is a really like malign term, right? If you say like I'm a craftsperson and I'm into craft or the field, it's like, almost like, okay, that's not. Like that's Etsy or that's some that you know I have a way of thinking of craft as like this sort of thing, but I think craft is about looking. I mean, the classes that I teach in this class recreating the past, where we're where we're I'm getting a signal, I have to go, where we are recreating these artworks, and you have a Vera Molnar piece and you do a recreation using a modern tool. And you're looking, and it's almost like that childhood game of spot the difference. You're looking at the original, you're looking at the recreation, you're saying this is a little darker, this is a little lighter, this is more, you know, this is more nuanced, this is more, you know, this is wilder, etc. That act of looking is the key to craft. That really it's about kind of close observation. And really being able to look at what you've made and the differences between these things, between what you want to make and what you have made. And so my classes are really about craft, and the work of the group is also about kind of exploring the nature of the craft of this medium.
Well, I have to let you go.
So. Yeah, I have to pick up my daughter. Right. But super, super nice conversation. And yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, of course. Of course. Thanks a lot. I wish you a great day. You have a day in front of you. It's like nighttime with me.
I do. It's, yeah, 3 o'clock.
Okay. Yeah, it's already that time. So thanks.
Okay.
Take care. Bye.
Der Design-Podcast der Burg.